Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Julia Rios, fiction editor of Strange Horizons, host of the Outer Alliance podcast, and one half of the Kaleidoscope YA anthology team. Welcome to the podcast, Julia.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
Now, I first came across your work on an episode of the Outer Alliance podcast, I think, where you interviewed the incorrigible Mr. Mond and the ever-articulate Kirsten McDermott.
Yeah, I stalked them until they agreed to be on my podcast.
Well, I wanted to ask you, just as a bit of an intro question, to smooth our way into the hard-hitting stuff that's coming. Just joking. I wanted to ask how you got into podcasting and what keeps you going in what is essentially a volunteer service.
Oh, how I got into podcasting. Well, I guess the first step was that I started listening to podcasts, and then I realized that I enjoyed listening to podcasts, and it was a way to reach people who maybe didn't want to read blogs. So I had been at that point blogging for the Outer Alliance, which still had a website, and I thought, why not start a podcast? So I talked to the founder and the other people who are running the Outer Alliance, and they said that it was a good idea, and I decided to do it. And of course, as a child, I was really, really interested in broadcasting. I didn't study it in school for some reason, but I remember there's one home video of my family, the only one that exists, and it's from the 80s. I'm about 8 years old, and my brother does skateboarding tricks. My sister runs around being an adorable three-year-old, and I spend the time pretending I'm a news anchor. So every time the camera turns on me, I say, "Hi, I'm coming to you live from Riverside," which is very silly. But given that I had this obsession with broadcasting, I also remember roping my friends and family into pretending to do radio shows. So, yeah, I basically had this obsession with broadcasting fake radio shows with me on a tape recorder that had a record button as well as a play button, and I don't think any of those tapes exist. I know that I used a lot of cassette tapes to, you know, you could tape over one of the holes, and that would make them possible to be recorded over, and I used them sometimes to record my favorite songs off the radio, but as often as not to make up my own radio talk shows. In light of that, it seems kind of inevitable that as an adult I would do the equivalent of making my friends and family record radio shows on tapes. So that's how I got into podcasting, and I guess that's probably why I stay.
Fair enough. I find that it's interesting. It's easier in some ways to just sit down and talk to somebody and interview them rather than, you know, send an email to an author, get them to answer questions and all that back and forth. But I presume you do your own post-production, do you? Or do you have some wonderful volunteer that does that for you?
I do it all myself. So any mistakes that you hear in post-production are all me. And it's one of these things where there is a lot of information out there on how to produce podcasts, and there's so much that I'm never quite sure what I should be paying attention to. So I kind of learn bits and pieces here and there, and every once in a while I try to up my game a little bit, but it's kind of sometimes feels like just shooting arrows into an empty field and hoping you happen to hit something without having a target.
All right, then. In addition to appearing on a number of podcasts, you also narrate short stories and poems, and I was curious, I think you probably answered part of this in the previous question, but I was wondering, is that something you put any training into or had any training in, and whether you'd been tempted to try longer sort of novel length readings?
I love reading aloud, and I think it's a lot of fun. I haven't got any real formal training. I did a little bit of community theater when I was in college, so I played Ophelia in Hamlet in Louisville, Indiana, so that's not a town you would have heard of. Even if you live in Indiana, you probably still wouldn't have heard of it. And that's pretty much the extent of my formal training. However, since I've started doing it, I've taken a lot of time to try to learn how other people who do read audiobooks and so forth go about it. And I try to, basically, every time I try to do something, I try to research it, and I try to learn what I can about it, and then I try to give it my best shot. And with the narrations, I really like it. I really like getting the chance to inhabit the piece. It's fun. It's different than reading something just straight up, because you're spending so much more time with those words. And that's, in some ways, a really intimate experience, which I really enjoy. I have thought about doing it for longer pieces. The question for me is how to get into that. I'm not quite sure how to break into the audiobook market, and I kind of think it would be a lot of fun and possibly a great opportunity, but I would want to get paid for it because it is a lot of work.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not quite the same level, but I do readings for kindergarten kids through my library work. So it's surprising how much talking, reading a book aloud and putting emphasis in can take out of you. So yeah, when you're doing that for a novel length work, I'm sure it's just a little bit harder.
Yeah, I think when you're doing a novel length work, you're talking for several days at a time, and you're just talking the whole day. So I don't think people really actually stop to think about how much a toll that takes on your voice physically.
And then you've got to sort of maintain that same, I suppose, level of effort and emphasis for that time as well. So it can be, which can be a difficult thing if you're not used to doing that for any length of time.
Yeah, you gotta keep your enthusiasm up. But hey, really cool that you read for kindergartners. That's a very wonderful thing to do.
And it is quite enjoyable, actually. Get instant feedback, so you know if they don't like it. I was going to go on to the Possible project in a second, but I was going to say it's not the first crowdsource project that you've been involved with. I mentioned before you're one of the fiction editors at Strange Horizons, which is probably coming up this evening to just finishing off its fundraising run. I think they're very close to their total. I wanted to ask, how did your association with Strange Horizons begin, and what do you like about being involved with that team in particular?
Well, I've been reading Strange Horizons off and on since it started in the year 2000, so I haven't read every single issue in real time, but I remember actually in the year 2000 reading one of the stories the first year. And so I was a longtime fan. I had the opportunity to meet Jed Hartman, who was one of the outgoing editors, a few years ago because he was friends with one of my mutual friends. And we just kind of hung out as friends. This was before any of the previous editorial team were thinking of leaving. But that's how I got introduced to the team who runs Strange Horizons. And when the three previous fiction editors all kind of decided to step down at roughly the same time, and they knew they had to replace themselves. So probably because he had met me before, Jed asked me if I would be interested in applying to be one of the new editors. And I had to think really hard about it because it was another long-term job that involved a lot of effort for no money. And I kind of do a lot of those. And I thought, no, this time I'm going to get paid. The next thing I take on, I'm going to have paid work. And then this opportunity fell into my lap. But it turned out to be so attractive that I decided to go ahead and do it anyway. And I don't regret the decision. I went through the application process, which was epic. It took something like 3 or 4 months for me to go through the entire editorial application process. And they really, really work hard to pick people that they think will be a good fit for the magazine. And I guess that's why I love working with my current editorial team. Britt Mandello and Anna Womayela are really great people, and we have – the way Strange Horizons works is a little different than the way a lot of other magazines work. We all have to agree on every single story we publish. So we spend a lot of time having discussions about the stories that we're considering and sort of sometimes vigorous debate depending. If one person really likes a story and the other two are kind of like, well, you'll have to work on convincing us here, then we can have lively chats about that. But it's really great. I think the very best part is when we see a story that all three of us immediately do like, and then instead of having a debate, we just have a conversation where we talk about why we love the story. I think that's the best possible thing about being an editor, when you find that story you love, and then you get to tell the author who wrote it that you love their story, and that makes them happy too.
We recently had Rashida Lunan-Ruiz on the show, and I asked the question that I'm going to ask to you now. So this is the hard stuff. When it comes to the discussion of diversity in speculative fiction, what do you think is the biggest misunderstanding people in our community have?
Okay, that is a tough question. I think one of the biggest this is a hard thing to answer because there are a lot of different things going on with diversity in science fiction. One of the biggest misunderstandings is that because there are a few of us working to promote diversity, that the market is saturated with diverse characters and stories. And actually, that's not true. It's just that there are a few people who are saying loudly that we need more of it. And another thing, I'm sorry, I'm not going to say the biggest misunderstanding. I'm just going to give you three different things.
So that's fine.
You asked me a hard question. I'm going to give you a hard answer. another thing that's going on is that there's, I think, an idea that if there are diverse characters, somehow that takes away opportunities for there to be other mainstream, default, white, straight, able-bodied, cisgendered characters. And I don't think that's true either. I think there really is room for everyone, and it's not that it isn't that the people who are championing diversity don't want everyone to have their fair share of story time. It's that we all want everyone to have their fair share of story time. And then the third thing that is, as I see it, a big problem is the tokenism that is sort of all spread throughout the publishing industry. We'll see people think that, okay, Octavia Butler is brilliant. She has written some brilliant science fiction stories, and everybody agrees that they're great. So therefore, we have the black science fiction writer, specifically the black woman who's a science fiction writer. So we don't need another one of those. And that's not true, because she's not the only person out there who can write brilliant stories who happens to be a black woman. We've got Nora Jemison and Nnedi Okorafor and Nalo Hopkinson and Karen Lord, and I could keep going, but I think you see the point. The point is that we have multiple people, and we probably have other newer voices that we haven't even discovered yet who are also brilliant black women who write great science fiction stories. But because people tend to think, okay, well, we've checked that box, so we've got one of those, we don't really need to go looking for more, I think they don't always get their fair shot. And this is hurt even more by the fact that sometimes what happens when people call for diversity is that you'll get people who are in the mainstream default paradigm, like the white, straight, able-bodied person, who will write outside of their own experience. And you'll get people sometimes, like Ian MacDonald, is writing stories that have been set in India, and then other white readers will read those and say, oh, okay, we've had a story set in India, so we don't need another story set in India. And even if the story that Ian MacDonald has written is very good, that's sad, because it takes away the chances from the people who actually have that experience and could be telling us stories from their own cultural experience and sharing that from the insider perspective. And I think our all of us would have richer reading experiences and lives for reading those stories. And I don't think that we can't have both of those things. It's just that for some reason, a lot of times when people are buying books, they think, oh, I've seen this one thing before, so I won't buy another one like it. And that's when I say people buying books, I mean actual publishers and editors and less the readers. I think readers tend to, if they like something, want to read another thing like it, which is awesome. But yeah, so that's, I think, the artificial sense that this is a zero-sum game, and it, once you have one thing that is ticking that diversity box, you can't have another one, is a big problem.
Yeah, and I suppose that in some ways that can come down to marketing too. If you've discovered the Indian Stephen King, for example, to quote an idea right off the top of my head, when another Indian Stephen King comes along, you've already used that sort of marketing avenue. So it's limiting in a sense. But I was also thinking back to your comments about you get two writers of a certain background in a room, and suddenly we're being overrun by writers of a certain background. In the sense that, you know, that's what the perception is from the dominant culture that might be occupying the room. Same as when, you know, you get two female authors walk into a room, suddenly it's the room's overcrowded with women, and there might be 15 other guys in the room.
Yeah, I mean, they've done actual studies with that where they've had groups of people in rooms talking and measured the amount that the two women actually talk, and it can be as little as 30% of the overall conversation, and people will say they've dominated it. It's like, actually, 30% is not domination.
No, it's just that, you know, that bit of extra sort of, or that bit of difference that's intruding on the mainstream that's pushing people out of their comfort zones, I suppose. I wanted to go on and talk about this project, Kaleidoscope, the YA project. You've teamed up with Elisa of 12th Planet Press, who was one of the founders of this podcast. She can't be with us tonight as she's growing a life form. I was wondering, what was the genesis of this particular project? In other words, how did she convince you to do it? Or was it you that did the convincing?
No, she came to me. She had heard the Outer Alliance podcast, I think it was episode 24, which I did after WISCON in 2012. I had been on a panel that Melinda Lowe had suggested and moderated, and it was about YA dystopian novels and heteronormativity. And Melinda Lowe was the moderator. Nisha Meminger and Kate Buettner were the two other panelists, and we talked about Melinda actually gave us homework. She had us read a couple of books so that we would have common talking points, and then we kind of branched out from there. And we talked about the sort of stock narrative that goes along with these YA dystopian romance novels, and they're usually romances, where you have a young girl and there's a love triangle. There's usually a boy from inside her dystopia and someone who comes from outside. And we talked about how those books seem to force the girl into having, they kind of force her choice. They force her to choose the boy who comes in from outside. And they don't actually let her have her own agency, even when it looks like she does, because even when she rebels, it's because she's been convinced by the boy from outside to rebel, and he tells her how. And so this can be a big problem, like even aside from the fact that there are no people who aren't straight. So Elisa listened to that, and she was really interested in it, and she originally approached me and asked me if I wanted to do an anthology of dystopian YA stories, and I said no to that because I know that there are already anthologies of dystopian YA stories, and I had at that point gotten burnt out on reading them. But I told her I would love to work on an anthology with her, and so we started to talk about what we could do that we would both enjoy reading for and putting out there. And we settled on YA contemporary fantasy because that was an area that we both really enjoy reading. And Elisa has published some great contemporary fantasy that I've enjoyed reading, so I knew that we would have overlapping taste there. And I was really excited to hear from Elisa because I've been a big a longtime fan of Galactic Suburbia. I've enjoyed reading the books that 12th Planet puts out. And so for me, I was immediately on board with the idea of working with her. And it was just a question of finding out what and then hitting on the project that excited us both. And this is definitely that project. We're both having a blast with it.
Okay. Now, to fund Kaleidoscope, you know, you've gone with crowdfunding, Possible, which I believe is like an Australian version of Kickstarter. Does, I suppose, got to be careful here because it's a commercial sort of in confidence, but what was the decision behind this? To get the work out sooner or...?
I think a lot of what drove this decision is that Elisa really wanted to try her hand at the crowdsourcing. She'd never done it before, and she thought, I don't want to do it alone, so she wanted to do it with me. We've seen a lot of other bigger publishers doing it. Ellen Datlow did it last year with The Fearful Symmetries, and Neil Clark of Clark's World, and John Joseph Adams. A lot of people are doing it. And so I think she's sort of watched those people and wondered exactly how it was working for them and if she could get involved in it, and was curious but didn't want to do it all by herself, wanted to have a special project for it, and didn't want to do something that she was already doing with it. And then when we started talking about this project, we decided we wanted to pay our authors the CIFWA pro rate of 5 cents a word, which is quite a lot of money, and we decided that that would be the right time to try to do this with a crowdfunded project, because paying 5 cents a word for a small press, where small presses, I don't think this is a big secret, I think it's pretty true across the board, they tend to lose money more than make it. So it's a labor of love.
And yep, that'd be my understanding, having spoken to several small press runners.
so we both wanted to be fair to the authors, but also knew that it wasn't something that we were necessarily going to be able to afford to do without opening it up to the rest of the world.
Okay. On that, whether it's Possible or Kickstarter, I was looking at the process this afternoon. It's not as simple as turning up and saying, here's an idea, give me money. I wondered if you could run us through your preparation for the launch of getting it to the stage where you're actually offering it to people. What was that process like, just on the organizational side of things with the company Possible?
Okay, well, Possible has, and Kickstarter I believe does too, an application process where you put in all of the information. You basically have to create the whole page that you're going to have as your live page and submit it for their approval. And then if they like it, they'll say yes. And if they think it needs work, they'll tell you what work they think it needs. And then you have the opportunity to rework it and then submit it again. I think Elisa and I both are pretty interested in doing things thoroughly and well, so we spent hours and hours organizing and preparing and talking on Skype, and we first decided, okay, these are the stories that we have that we know we're going to put into the anthology, so this is a good starting point. We'll make sure those authors are willing to be named in our promotional campaign. Then we started thinking through the rewards levels, and that took ages. We had to scrap several different ideas for rewards, because I think one of the things that has historically been a challenge for people who have run crowdfunding projects like this is that they offer rewards that they think are good ideas, and then when it comes down to delivering them, they realize that all of the money they've raised is going to the rewards. So people who offer things like mugs and T-shirts, I think, have gotten bitten pretty hard after the money comes in and they realize that there's nothing left over for the project itself. And we didn't want that to happen to us, but we also still wanted to give people who backed it something nice to say thank you. So we had to spend a lot of time running numbers on how much delivering rewards would actually cost us and how much money we would be able to keep for the project. And Elisa kept saying she felt bad because she didn't want to charge as much money at various levels as she was, and she felt like people would think publishers were just really mean and greedy. And I was like, yeah, but if we run the numbers and afterwards we can't deliver the project that we're actually supposed to be making, then I think that will look worse.
Yeah, and I think probably people underestimate too the amount of cost that's involved in producing books. So, so there's a bit of a reality check there for some people. I can remember when the Alan Datlow fundraiser was going on, that there were people that were complaining that, you know, I think it was 30,000 they tried to raise, and was it with Trizine that were doing it as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and they were saying, oh, you know, there was grumbling, and I just think people just don't realise, you know, aside from small press doing it on the smell of an oily rag, that it does require quite a bit of money if you're going to treat everyone with respect and pay them. I was going to say, I think most folks can see why diversity is a good theme choice and why it's needed. The decision behind going with a young adult, was that more a sense of you probably get the most bang for your buck going for younger readers if you're wanting to inform or educate the science fiction and fantasy community?
I think it was honestly, I think it all came out of that one panel, and that panel happened to be on YA, and I think that got Elisa thinking about YA and about the fact that 12th Planet hasn't done a lot of it, and she wanted to move into that. And I enjoy YA, so that was fine with me. I was kind of coming at it from the point of view of being like, well, it would be great to work with you. What's a project that we would both be interested in? And we started talking about things. She was interested in YA. I wasn't particularly interested in dystopia, so we decided let's do YA and not dystopia. We both enjoy reading it, and I think that, yes, you can actually make an impression on younger readers, because I think that we're already seeing younger people being more accepting of things that the older generation is not. I think that, for instance, same-sex marriage is something that's a non-issue for a lot of younger people and still kind of hard for their parents and grandparents to accept. And part of that is just because they've grown up in a world where a lot of people are modeling it for them and they're seeing that it's not actually scary.
No, that's fair enough. Yeah, I don't have any particular issue with young adult fiction. Obviously, being a school librarian, I'd be odd if I did. But no, I was just wondering if that was perhaps part of the reason. But no, I agree. I'm just trying to think. There's possibly one 12th Planet Press book that's actually catalogued as YA. But
is that Nightsiders?
It is.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think. I'm just trying to remember the stories, each of the individual stories. It was a long time ago. Didn't strike me as particularly YA, but then that's a fairly broad field too. So
yeah, YA encompasses a lot, and I think Nightsiders does actually fit the profile since it does have a teen protagonist. There's Ash, the boy. I think, I don't know. I also think that Elisa was interested in the idea that 12th Planet Press might have her books in libraries. So that would be in school libraries. That would be an exciting thing. And I think she liked having that with Nightsiders and would like to see more of that because, hey, if we can hook more people into reading 12th Planet Press books when they're young, maybe they'll grow into the older ones, which are really not YA books.
It's a gateway drug.
Exactly.
Gateway book. I was going to say, what would you say to those listeners who... Actually, I'm thinking of this question. I don't actually think many of our listeners would have this issue, but what would you say to those people then who might think that the project is issues-based, in inverted commas, and that the theme of diversity might not be their kind of speculative fiction?
Well, I think that one of the things we're specifically trying to do with this project is to have a lot of really interesting fantasy stories. I was going to say fun, but then I realized that they're not all fun. Some of them will be fun and some of them will be heartbreaking. That's kind of how we roll. We have the mixture. But they'll all be interesting, and they'll all be interesting not just because these characters are coming from diverse viewpoints. They're going to be interesting because they're fantasy stories in their own right, and they are the kinds of stories that we believe anybody should be able to connect with and enjoy. I think that's part of what I care about with diversity. I'm half Mexican. I'm bisexual. I grew up not seeing a lot of people like me reflected in work that I read and saw on TV and movies and so forth. And so I had to identify with people who weren't necessarily like me. And I think a lot of people actually do that. I think people think that they can't identify with people who aren't like them, which is funny because I think a lot of people in the world are not actually 13-year-old straight white boys who are American. And that's actually what a lot of the protagonists are. And people identify with them. So I think for us, making an anthology full of stories that featured people who weren't like that default, but were interesting stories that were engaging and fun to read, was the goal. And so far, we've got 4 stories, and we love them, and we are really excited to share them with everyone else. So I think we're on the right track.
I'm pretty sure you are. I was just checking this afternoon, but I know it's gone up since then. At the time of recording, which is not exactly right, but earlier on today, you were just over 25% funded, still with pretty much 80% of your campaign time to run. You've already got some well-known writers, as you've alluded to there, and I'll mention two here, Ken Liu and Sophia Samatar. You're going to, when you hit the halfway mark, you're going to open up for submissions. I'll just throw it open to you. Who can submit, and what are you not looking for in your submissions?
Open up at the $7,000 mark in the fundraiser. So as soon as we hit $7,000, we'll post those guidelines for everyone in the world to see. And we do, so that we really wanted to have the open call specifically so that we could encourage people who we had never heard of to submit to us. And we're really looking for people who have not necessarily had their chances to tell their stories, to share their stories with us, and hoping that we find some great new voices to share along with the established writers. We want to see contemporary fantasy, so fantasy set in the modern world, and with a teen protagonist who is coming from a diverse background. What we don't want to see are fantasies that are not set in the modern world. So if it's really all set in a secondary world, that's probably not right for this anthology. We don't want to see stories where the main character is a straight white boy, and his friend is somehow the diverse character, but as a supporting role. So we don't want to see, we don't want to see the story about a 15-year-old boy whose adopted sister is somehow, autistic and gay, and she happens to be there some of the time, and maybe he has to defend her. That's definitely not what we want to see. We want to see the story told from her point of view, and we want to see stories that are well-researched, that even if you are writing from outside your own personal experience, you've done the work to actually find out how to portray this with authenticity and not being disrespectful to the people who actually fit the profile of the character that you're writing, because there are real people out there who will fit the profile of the character you're writing, and we want to make sure that they don't feel like they've been treated with disrespect.
No, I think that's fairly clear. You don't want 100 submissions from people that have just gone, I'll take the story that I did over here and just slip a character in that fits the diverse criteria, which I'm sure none of our listeners would be doing that. I was just going to say it's been a pleasure talking with you, Julia. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity and thank you for putting up with the constant dropouts that are going to be edited out of this podcast, so our listeners will be none the wiser. Good luck with Kaleidoscope and with everything else you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm a listener to Galactic Chat, so, or as my iPod's voiceover likes to call it, Galactic Hat.
Excellent.